Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news, as well as insight and analysis into all the subjects you're talking about and debating in football. I'm Ian McGarry, and as ever, I am joined by Duncan Castles for today's pod, and we will be talking some very, very interesting news lines. Duncan, we're going to start with Paul Pogba, who, of course, as we all know, is out of contract at Manchester United in the summer. His desire has always been to go to Real Madrid, and that has not certainly progressed any. There have been some conversations, but no offers. However, you have information regarding his former club and interest, and of course their manager, whom he knows very well.
Yeah, this basically Max Allegri has instructed Juventus that he wants two players to build a new team around, one of which he's already got, Dusan Vlahovic. That battle they had with Arsenal to secure Vlahovic in the January transfer window and give themselves a centre forward that they hope can be the principal striker at the club for the next decade. The other is Paul Pogba. So Allegri went into that window asking Juventus to secure both of those players if they could. Obviously, they ended up pushing their financial resource into getting Vlahovic done in that window. And Pogba would have required a transfer fee from Manchester United and a decision from the player that his next club was going to be the one he played for before moving to Manchester United on that initial €105 million transfer in 2016. As you say, Pogba's preference has been Real Madrid. There have been conversations. There's been a kind of line from Florentino Perez going back before last summer that Pogba should run his contract down, that he was interested in signing him, but he wouldn't be paying a transfer fee. So run your contract down and we'll have conversations once you're able to come to us for free. Knowing that Pogba's preference was to go to the club, there are very few other potential suitors. Paris Saint-Germain is another obvious candidate. He wants a massive salary. And he wants to go to a club where he can win titles, having spent now in his sixth season at Manchester United and having just a League Cup and a Europa League to show for that period there. The Allegri interest is fascinating because I think it's fair to argue that Pogba's best two club seasons of his career came under Allegri at Juventus, who took over halfway through that period in which Pogba spent in Italy. He had 61 Serie A appearances under Allegri, scored 16 goals, 17 assists, won two Scudetti and two Coppa Italia. And compare that to his now almost six seasons at Manchester United, 144 Premier League appearances, 29 goals and 40 assists, and the number of appearances declining as the years go on. Allegri had a very good relationship with Pogba when they worked together. I think we've told the story on the podcast before about how Allegri would play basketball with Pogba at the training ground and joke around with him, and found a way to get the best we've seen out of him in club football. Pogba and Raiola have managed the situation at Manchester United into one where they should be able to secure the maximum financial package, and it's now in their control as to what they do. United can no longer take a transfer fee on a player who, as long ago as 2018, Jose Mourinho was recommending to the club should be sold because he'd become a problem, and there'd been a mistake had been made in signing him, part of which was down to Mourinho himself, and that the club should cash in while they could and place that money elsewhere. United can't do that anymore. They are still briefing that they are interested in retaining the player, but they know that having allowed the contract to run down, because Pogba has resisted the offers that they have proposed to him in that period, they have to go into a straight fight against clubs like Juventus, Paris Saint-Germain and Real Madrid if they decide to make offers for his services. And so that there's a decision to be made this summer. He has a clear suitor now in Italy. They also have the advantage of the tax laws that benefit foreign players coming into the country. So they're able to offer a higher net salary for relative to gross spend than the rivals for his signature. And we must wait and see if anyone else is able to go as far as Juventus are prepared to go for the player.
It's a pretty high salary to play for a player just so that you can have a game of one-on-one on the basketball court. And also, I know I'd be backing Allegri's about 5'10". So I'm not sure there's much of a competition there with regards to that particular duo play basketball.
Well, there's the genius of Allegri. Play one-on-one basketball with Paul and let him win and get him onside instead of having arguments with him about how he should perform on the football pitch. He's also able to sell not just the personal relationship, he's able to sell this is where you succeeded. Come back to a team who's invested in players like Vlahovic, we're rebuilding, you will win Serie A trophies again here. And we are going to try and build something that's competitive in the Champions League and basically to be more competitive than Manchester United have been in the Champions League really isn't that hard.
So, Paul Pogba, it does look like a formality that he will leave Manchester United in the summer, being out of contract. But more problems for the club with regards to things that are happening both on and off the field. Bounced out of the FA Cup and then drawing with Burnley, who are relegation contenders. Ralph Rangnick, who was very honest in his assessment and said, you can't come to a club who've won almost nothing in 10 years and then turn it around in 2 months or even 6 months. It takes longer than that, even at Manchester United. Rangnick, I'm told, by sources very close to the Manchester United dressing room, is frustrating many of his players with decisions that he's made, both in team structure, tactics, formation, but also his treatment and decision-making, although, of course, it would have been taken in conjunction with other people, of Mason Greenwood, given his problems off the field. But football players being instinctively selfish would rather simply ignore things like that because Greenwood is a very, very talented player and they know that not having him available disadvantages them as a team with regards to winning football matches. We said on the podcast, Duncan, some time ago that even though Rangnick turned up at Old Trafford believing he could persuade the club and perform at a level high enough to be offered a job full time, that instead, that's definitely not the case, and that the search for a new head coach had already started. How do you solve a problem like that when players A are already looking at the coach as a lame duck, with still 4 months of the season left? And now they're out of the FA Cup, so their only target is to get into Europe, and that would be Champions League. But at the same time, will they play for a coach that they know is not going to be there next season? Because we all know that's the kind of thing that really doesn't work in football when players know that the guy they're playing under is not going to be there. You think about coaches who've announced their retirement before the end of the season. And if he's well liked, then yes, the players will play for him. But if it's that's indifference, then the performance levels just slip and slip.
Look, through the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer era, we had heard a lot about cultural reboots at Manchester United and how important it was for them to change the culture of the club in order to turn themselves into competitors again at the top end of the league and competitors again in Europe's Premier competition. What I'm hearing from various sources at Manchester United is that the dressing room culture at Manchester United is a mess for some of the reasons you're talking about. One of the issues is leadership. One of the issues is respect for the coaching staff. And that feeds through into performances. We've seen Ranić's inability to turn things around. We talked some time ago now about mistakes he made early on in his process, the tactical system he used, his choice of assistant coaches brought in from the MLS who were described to me by players working under them that they're not bad coaches. It's not that they're not trying hard, but ultimately they're MLS level. They're an improvement on Solskjaer, but they're not to the standard required at a club that wants to be one of the top clubs in European football. There have been organisational issues which have failed to impress players. You have a dressing room that's split. You have senior players upset with the attitude and performance levels and the ability of younger players to follow instruction. You've seen that Cristiano Ronaldo long interview where he emphasised how players needed to change their attitude and application if Manchester United were to be successful again. I think that's very revealing and important about what's going on at United now. And as you say, they have now got themselves in a position where they have an interim manager who they need to get them back into the Champions League for next season, but who the players are not performing for. The performance levels have not changed in any radical fashion since he came in. And the players now know that he's not going to stay there, so they wait to see who the next manager is. They have to solve that problem of recruiting the next man, and they have to make changes to the squad without knowing who the next man is going to be. And you know, you have, for example, Maurizio Pochettino pushing very hard for the job, wanting to get out of Paris Saint-Germain, trying to get that job when Solskjaer was sacked and put Paris Saint-Germain not allowing him to leave, and trying again to get it at present, knowing that United have wanted to hire him in the past. There's a big swell of support, I think, from the fan base that Erik ten Hag should be brought from Ajax to solve the problems and improve the level of football. But I think everywhere you look at Manchester United at the moment, there are issues, big issues for them to solve. And you see repetition of the problems they've had for multiple years in the performances and in the games. In the match against Burnley, we see Harry Maguire losing contact with Wout Weghorst, then being beaten with him 1-on-1, not having the recovery pace to stop Jay Rodriguez scoring an equaliser. And look at that goal carefully. What do you see? Luke Shaw playing everyone onside for no reason. And then halting his recovery run so he doesn't get back in time to stop Rodriguez's shot. How many times have we seen this issue at Manchester United over the season since Maguire was brought in as the most expensive defender by transfer fee in the history of the game? Ranić can't solve that. Those are players who will never be part of a top-level winning Manchester United starting lineup. It's clear. And United are going to have to take big hits on their salaries and their transfer fees in order to change it. But that they have so many many elements to put in place and to solve at present. It's I do not envy Ralph Rangnick or any of the staff at Manchester United their jobs at present.
I was going to say, Duncan, I looking at it and looking at the club's performance level since Sir Alex Ferguson retired, obviously they had relative success under Jose Mourinho with the Europa League, a League Cup and a second place finish. But who would take the job? I mean, it's an absolute shambles.
Well, Pochettino would take the job in a flash. Yes, yeah. He is desperate. He is desperate to get the job. He's desperate to get back to English football. He's pushing.
You wait for Manchester City, though.
I think if he had the opportunity to wait for Manchester City, then and both jobs were coming up at the same time, then sure, he'd prefer the Manchester City job. The question is, would he be given the Manchester City job? And the bigger question for Manchester United is he the right person to give the Manchester United job, given his failures at Paris Saint-Germain? The players at Paris Saint-Germain like him as an individual, but they don't rate him as a coach. And he hasn't enjoyed his time over there. He's going to win the French League, but you should be winning the French League as PSG coach. The question is, can you take that supremely well furnished squad and turn them into Champions League winners? And the noises coming from people very close to Pochettino are the kind of things we talked about when he went there and when they hired Lionel Messi. It's the difficulties of combining all those superstars into one team and the difficulty of handling the superstars when they have greater status than you do. So if you want to hire Pochettino, that's fine. You do it on what he did in his earlier career and his earlier period at Tottenham. But if you look at the latter stages of his career from that run into getting sacked at Tottenham and then what he's done at Paris Saint-Germain, I don't think he's an obvious candidate to solve the scale of problems Manchester United have. But what's clear is he wants that job.
Well, that's my point. Who is? Who is the candidate? Who is the coach who can come in and turn that ship around and get going in the right direction again? Because it seems to be a very fruitless challenge at the moment because of so many problems that are there.
Yeah, and I agree. And there's a limited supply of elite coaches in the European market at the moment, and that's the quandary United are in. They've built themselves into this state of disrepair, which is unacceptable to the supporters, and which is clearly dysfunctional. They have to solve it, and the question you ask is, do they have the personnel in charge now that Ed Woodward's left? Now you have a new chief executive in place. Do they have the experience to be able to make the best selection from the coaches available, or to go and persuade someone who's at another club who they think are better than coaches who would be offering themselves for the position to come there and turn things around?
Well, they must be cursing the fact that when they employed David Moyes, albeit he was treated badly, they missed out on Carlo Ancelotti, who I think is probably one of the only coaches currently who would be able to do what seems like an impossible job at Manchester United. And of course, he's at Real Madrid now, again, for the second time. So that's not going to happen. Speaking of Pochettino, Duncan, his former club, Tottenham Hotspur, we've spoken about this before in the podcast, that every team apart from Manchester City in the Premier League is effectively for sale. If the right offer comes in. Maybe Newcastle United don't come into that category anymore, having been sold. And you have information regarding interest in buying Spurs.
Yeah, this comes from Los Angeles, United States, a NASDAQ listed, what's called a special purpose acquisition company, a SPAC, called LAMF Global Ventures. They floated on the NASDAQ stock market in November, raised over $250 million in their initial public offering. And it was an offering that was oversubscribed. They're very confident they can raise substantial sums on top of that. Interesting group of people behind them, including the chairman, Jeffrey Soros, who is the nephew of billionaire investor George Soros. Also using as a special advisor on football, Keith Harris, who has been involved, I think, in more takeovers of English football clubs than anyone else in the financial world in terms of brokering those deals. They want, I'm told, to buy an elite European football club. Their preference is to buy into the Premier League, ideally one of the big six clubs. My understanding is that the principal target has always been Tottenham Hotspur, because it's known that Daniel Levy and Joe Lewis have built it up into a way that it's ripe to be sold by the over £1 billion investment in the training ground and the stadium, London location, the achieving Champions League status, although that's now gone, and getting close to winning the Premier League title. Keith Harris, I'm told, approached Daniel Levy recently and presented LAMF's interest in the club to Tottenham's chairman. My understanding is that he pitched the valuation that LAMF would place on Tottenham at £3 billion in the hope that Levy would be interested in selling at that price, or selling a percentage of their shares at that price. Instead, I'm told Levy rebuffed them. Guidance from a club source is that he cut the conversation short and didn't even engage on the price, didn't want to get involved in bargaining over a number. And I'm told that was nothing to do with the figure, the valuation that was being placed on the club. It wasn't an issue that Levy felt LAMF were undervaluing Tottenham at £3 billion, but because of their status as a SPAC, and therefore the need for Tottenham to go public should a transaction occur with LAMF. The structure of these deals and the rules associated with SPACs is such that when they buy an asset like Tottenham or a football club, that would then be listed on the stock market. And as it was explained to me, Tottenham deliberately came off the stock market in order to raise money to overhaul their stadium and overhaul their training ground and rebuild the stadium from scratch. And it's in their interest to stay off the market. Now, independent industry experts who have asked about this say the same thing. They don't think a SPAC purchase of Tottenham is the most efficient way to go about it, either from a financial perspective or in the interest of the football club. So it didn't surprise them that Levy refused to engage. The question is what happens next with that pool of money that LAMF have gathered together and they believe they can add to. There is a time limit in terms of when they have to make an acquisition. They have to buy something by a certain point in time, otherwise the money has to be returned to their investors. They're looking at other football clubs, looking in the Premier League, although it's difficult to see another big six club that it's possible for them to buy. There are alternative options such as Everton, which clearly are not as attractive as Tottenham, come with a large number of problems. And then you can go outside English football and look at clubs like Milan, which also come with significant complications. But interesting that there's this pool of money an interest from America to buy another major club in England, and a marketplace being kind of excavated at the moment to see if a deal can be done.
I think I might give their number to the administrators at Derby County. See if they're interested in buying them out. So we'll move on to Chelsea, Duncan, and it is our understanding at the Transfer Window podcast that they are in the market this coming summer for a striker. It is Thomas Tuchel's belief that they are overloaded with attacking midfielders who are not producing the goals which he would expect from the players like Kai Havertz and Pulisic. Therefore, Paulo Dybala at Juventus has come into and onto their radar with regards to moving to Stamford Bridge in the summer. He's someone who has interested many European clubs over the last year or so, having expressed some dissatisfaction with his playing time at Juve. He has played in 18 games this season and scored 7 goals. Obviously, he is a dynamic and also very forceful player. Lukaku, who upset Tuchel with his comments that he would have rather stayed at Inter had they offered him a new contract rather than go to Chelsea. But Lukaku has no real backup with regards to him being out with an injury. Most recently, Dybala would be a point striker as well. Do you think it's a good fit, Duncan?
Look, it's no surprise to me that Chelsea are looking at the option. Dybala's out of contract in the summer. He has been offered around English clubs and European clubs on numerous occasions. There's been this ongoing saga of him getting very close to renewing his contract at Juventus, but it never actually happening. He has varied in his status at Juventus, being dropped out of the lineup and then coming back in under various coaches. Played two-thirds of the Serie A games as a starter this season and been quite important to them, but they have decided to put their money into Dusan Vlahovic instead. Dybala will be 29 this year. He has a patchy injury record. I think what you're seeing here is his representatives assessing a busy market for free agents this summer and seeing what the best option available to him is. And it's understandable that Chelsea are talking and finding out what his salary request would be and considering whether it's something that would strengthen them or not. They're in a difficult stage at the moment, and I think your friend Tam Tuchel is also hitting headwinds at Chelsea in a way that he hadn't done at any stage before, and needs a turnaround in form. Otherwise, he's going to start coming under the pressure that we know always comes onto Chelsea managers when Roman Abramovich and Marina Granovskaya feel they're underperforming relative to the investment that's been made in the team.
Very true. Chaos theory is one way I've heard Chelsea's managerial politics described as. So even though he won the Champions League, he could well find himself out of a job if they don't start to pick up look like they're making progress before the end of this season. But again, the problem would be, Duncan, that candidates to replace are thin on the ground. So that's something that they'll have to take into account. Someone who has got no problems in terms of finding a new job is Dan Ashworth, who is Brighton's technical director. And we flagged up to you on the podcast that Newcastle United had made an offer to him. And that was some time ago. So yet again, we brought you that news before anyone else. And it was this week announced that he had resigned his role at Brighton Hove Albion and that he would be moving to another Premier League club. That club is Newcastle United. But Duncan, apparently, he's become the Alan Titchmarsh of football.
Yeah, he's placed on extended gardening leave by Brighton and Hove Albion. My understanding is that the extent of that extended gardening leave is 9 months, which raises an interesting question for both Newcastle United and Brighton and Hove Albion, because if you're decided that Ashworth is the best pick for that important sports director role, which is what Amanda Staveley and co have done. And it is a substantial role. We're talking about basically an overhaul of Newcastle United from bottom up, running the gamut of training ground, including things like the women's team, the first team, obviously the mandate as has become clear, or now public, an element of public record to it, because new signing Bruno Guimaraes talked about it. Something, again, we reported early on in the podcast, that they want to be competing for the Premier League and the Champions League in 5 years' time. So that is an amazing mandate to have as a sports director. It's something that Ashworth has never taken on before. It's a different scale of job to anything he's done before, but he has... I think an attractive area for them is his work with the Football Association. They want to focus as much as they can on English talent. Ashworth has good connections and a background there. But do they buy him out of his gardening leave? Because 9 months is a long time to wait if you're trying to get yourself to the Champions League final in less than 5 years' time, and this is your sporting director with that scale of job required for him. Or do you pay Brighton and Hove Albion, or try to pay Brighton and Hove Albion the money that's required to compensate him for the remaining time in his contract? That, I understand, would be less than £1 million. As we reported when that offer came in, Newcastle have more than doubled his salary. It doesn't seem like much of an extra investment. I guess the question would be whether Tony Bloom, as owner of Brighton, could hold Ashworth to his contract should Newcastle decide to buy it out at full value, whether legally he's allowed to do that, or whether if the full value of the contract is offered to him, he has to allow Ashworth to leave.
I think it's interesting, Duncan, that... the transfer recruitment policy in January at Newcastle, as you reported initially, that the new owners were not going to be ostentatious in the way that they spent money in January because they felt that would be the wrong thing to do. It would send out the wrong signals. They would get ripped off, etc., etc. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. They were ostentatious. They bought Chris Wood for... a ridiculous amount of money for a 30-year-old striker from Burnley. Bruno Guimaraes is also a record signing. Look, they need Ashworth in place to organise their summer recruitment, that's for sure, and make sure that it is sensible and that it's well organised and that it's team building rather than scattergun. I think you're right to say that Newcastle have to make a decision about paying out of the contract of Ashworth at Brighton Hove Albion, because Ashworth, of course, resigned. He wasn't sacked, so therefore he's not due to be paid except for his monthly salary on his notice period. So if Newcastle want them to be working for them on the ground, then they will have to pay compensation to Brighton. So that's where the rock and a hard place is with regards to Newcastle and getting at Ashworth Inn in order to do the job that they're looking for him to do ahead of the summer window.
Yeah, and Brighton obviously have to find a replacement. Dan Ashworth was the first sports director they've had at the club. I understand that Tony Bloom was happy with his performance and didn't want to lose Ashworth. As we reported on the podcast, he offered him a pay rise to stay on and hoped that Ashworth would take that, although he wasn't prepared to match the money, the excessive money in his view that was on offer at Newcastle United. I understand that they have initiated a process of looking for a replacement and are using a headhunting company in order to provide a list of names for the club to consider before making an appointment. I think you're right to flag up the mess that Newcastle made of the January window and why Ashworth and a change in recruitment style is going to be fundamental to them achieving what they want to achieve on the playing field. Yes, they initially wanted to avoid spending in January, and then they came basically to a pragmatic conclusion that they were going to go down if they didn't spend, and got forced into, as one person describes it to me, making every mistake that they were warned against making in the window. So some interesting comments from the German defender Robin Gosens, who chose to join Inter from Atalanta rather than Newcastle United, and talked about turning down a much richer contract at Newcastle in order to stay at Inter for sporting reasons. He said, I find it very human to think about it, referring to the money. If you can earn a multiple for the same job in a different location, show me someone who just says, no, thank you. And then said, well, and with this offer, the pros were clearly playing in the Premier League and the lucrative contract offer, but the cons were a few too many. I would have jeopardized my sporting goals. At the end of my career, I would like to look in the mirror and say, I got the most from my sporting career. With Newcastle, I didn't have that feeling from the start. Now, that speaks to a problem with the way Newcastle are selling the project to targets, because they were not able to convince Gosens that even though they could offer him much more money than Inter were offering him, that it was the right place to go, and they need to change that. Bruno Guimarães, it wasn't a problem. Guimarães liked it by his own explanation. He liked what the project was that was being sold to him, and he was happy to move to Newcastle on that basis and take the superior money on offer there. But they lost players who were preferred targets because they weren't able to convince them that Newcastle is the right sporting project at present.
It's interesting because I was speaking to an agent who knows Gosens' agent, and Gosens didn't know who was in charge, as in who was head coach at Newcastle. And so he asked his agent, who's the head coach? And his reply, Gosens' reply was, Eddie who? He said, and his agent said, no, Eddie Howe. He said, Eddie who? So there you go. I don't think that's really going to help Newcastle's cause if that's the kind of response you're getting from players you're trying to recruit about your new head coach. It's time for hero and villain, and we have interesting candidates for you this week. Duncan, do you want to go first with villain, or shall I go first with hero?
I'll do the villain, who unusually for the podcast is going to remain unnamed, but let's say he is a representative of Wayne Rooney, who called me out of the blue back in January 2017, after I'd written an article for the Sunday Times about Jose Mourinho's plans to reconstruct the Manchester United squad, in order to get them to the top of the European game. It's interesting that back in 2017, we're talking about that, and we're talking about it still on this podcast. One of the players he was targeting, which I reported in the story, was Antoine Griezmann. I think we discussed that pursuit in detail on the podcast. Why was Wayne Rooney's representative interested in a story about Mourinho and Antoine Griezmann? Well, in the sixth paragraph, there was a mention of Rooney, in which I said, though United have avoided publicly discussing the readiness to move Rooney off their books, there is a recognition within Old Trafford that the captain's status as an automatic starter has been lost to fitness and lifestyle issues. Were Rooney to accept an offer from elsewhere, he has been the subject of hugely lucrative approaches from the Chinese Super League, United would gladly be relieved of the 31-year-old's remuneration. Why did the guy take offence? He said, it was not correct of me to talk about Rooney's lifestyle issues, as that would have a damaging effect on his client. And my response was to ask him if he'd actually read the piece and read what I'd said, and he admitted he hadn't read the piece, and then he had a look at it. And then I said, look, I've got multiple very well-placed sources telling me that Rooney's lifestyle is affecting his sporting performance. And I know that story is correct. And I don't see how you can object to me talking about lifestyle issues in one sentence when just a few weeks beforehand, your client was on the front page of The Sun in a story about how he'd spent the day drinking in England's team hotel and ended up at a wedding that was being held there. The headline of the Sun's story, Wayne Rooney almost punched by wedding guest after drunk England captain was getting handy with his wife. Now, think about all that in the
context. Wasn't the bride, was it?
It wasn't. Well, according to the story, it wasn't the bride. Think about all of that in the context of an extraordinary interview Rooney gave to Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times last weekend, ahead of the launch of a documentary in which he tells a lot of stories about his career. And he talked about his drinking problem, said to Jonathan that he got involved in what he described as a self-binge, basically, which helps you forget things. But when you come out of it, you're going back to work and it's still there. So it was doing more damage than good. And then he said that he would, at that period, he would study United's training schedule. And this is a quote, if I saw a couple of days window, I thought, right, that's a couple of days where I can go at it and forget things. Then he'd dust myself down and use eye drops and get through that week's training. I was in a really bad place. And I recount this just as an example of what we have to deal with as sports journalists working for UK papers, and how the extreme libel laws in the UK allow people to try and scare you into not even making oblique references to something that you are aware is going on in an article. And then, lo and behold, 5 years later, Rooney comes out and talks in great detail about the problems he's had with alcohol for large periods of his football career.
Well, no need to explain that one to me, Duncan. You know very well the kind of scrapes I've got into with different players and agents and managers over the years. Here for us this week is a friend of the podcast, as Johnny Northcroft, of course, is as well, is Luis Campos, the former sports director at Monaco and Lille. This week, CIES, who compiles statistics on football around Europe, reported that Lille have made the most profit on transfers in the top five leagues in the last 5 years, a time, of course, when Luis was sports director there. Let's not forget he also recruited the likes of Kylian Mbappe and Bernardo Silva to Monaco, who were then sold for record sums as well. He was also part of the Lille management team, who beat the mighty Paris Saint-Germain to the league title. So we are awarding our hero to Luis Campos this week. We hope we might see him in the Premier League soon, because he has an interest, as we know, in coming to England. This has been the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news. You can engage with us, and please do, on our social media channels. We're at Transfer Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Duncan is on at Duncan Castles on Twitter. I'm on at GarboSJ on Twitter. You can also search us on YouTube if you want to access the podcast that way. That's all for today. Just leaves us to say stay safe, be well, and thank you for listening.